Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 5th, 2018. This Thursday's class is the week 11 class of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study, based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. Our study this week is on rebirth. There was two newcomers in our class this evening, and prior to the talk on rebirth, I gave a brief introductory talk on what the Buddha actually taught. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
Oh, well, I'm glad you joined us tonight. You'll, I was just telling Chris, we are in the tail end of a 12-week course based on one of the books that I wrote called The Truth of Happiness. And tonight's talk is on rebirth. So unless you have unless you have a good understanding of what the Buddha taught, this is a little bit out of context, but I don't think it will be for you. And I think you'll pick it up, Chris. You might find some differences between what I teach, or at least my approach, and what you're used to. You might not, though. I keep my teachings focused on just what the Buddha taught that's preserved in the Sutta Pitaka, in the suttas. I've been studying and practicing and teaching for quite a few years, and I found that to be the most effective. The reason why I say this is because of your background. I don't want you in any way to take offense that I'm pointing out when I point out that there's differences between this and some other teachings. Yeah. It's just, I think it's important just to understand just what the Buddha taught, and then what has developed over the years. And that's really what made the difference for me when I focused on just what the Buddha taught. So that's what I teach here. So it's such a pleasure to have you here, Tony. And I really would, whatever comments you'd like to say, please feel free. The Cross River Meditation Center is focused on that. In other words, what goes on here, what we talk about, what we focus on, what the Sangha develops is just that. It's out of the Sutta Pitaka. So I work hard, or I strive for keeping that part of it pure. I occasionally point out the differences between what the Buddha taught and what has developed. But that's, if you can deal with that.
I love hearing that. It's great.
Oh, good. And the reason why I give it such a long qualification and maybe wasting a few minutes of all your time is I don't want most people that are interested in meditation and mindfulness have been reading about Buddhism, and it becomes, if you don't have the proper context, it becomes very confusing with this school and that school and what they're teaching, what's the point. And that's how it was for me, and it wasn't until I studied just what the Buddha taught that it became clear what he was hoping to do. So now that I've gone that far, I better go a little bit further for Chris too. As I mentioned before, the Buddha was a human being who, through his own efforts, the word is awakened, which to me, I think the best description of what is awakening is gaining full human maturity. And if you think about what maturity means, is a fully developed mind, at least as far as something is concerned. In this case, it's a fully developed mind as far as understanding Four Noble Truths. So the Buddha awakened to this profound understanding that it was ignorance of these Four Noble Truths that leads to all the suffering in the world. And so his very first teaching was, it's called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. That is the sutta where, for the first time in human history, as far as we know, he taught what these four truths are. And he taught these truths to the five friends that he had been wandering around northern India for the previous 6 years. Upon hearing this first talk, and it was a very brief talk, one of his friends awakened. His name was Kandana. And when he heard the Buddha's teachings, when the Buddha concluded, Kandana declared, "All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation." And the Buddha said, "You are now Anakandana," which means you understand. Ana means understanding, Kandana. That seems almost too simple until you understand the profound understanding that Kandana had developed after hearing those words just for the first time. The entire Buddhist teachings is focused on something called these three conditions of impermanence, the not-self-characteristic, and the resulting dukkha. And so Kandana declared a profound understanding of the ever-changing nature of all things. And it's because as human beings, remember the Buddha wrote into ignorance of Four Noble Truths? It is ignorance of the nature of impermanence, this misunderstanding of what constitutes a self and the resulting suffering, that keeps us wandering around in this ignorance. And so it's a characteristic of ignorance to create strategies to ignore its own ignorance. The Buddha realized this upon his awakening. That continued ignorance of Four Noble Truths is also called deluded thinking. Upon his awakening, the Buddha considered for 2 more weeks, how can I teach this, what I now understand, to people's minds that are deluded, that are rooted in ignorance? And now if you think about that, if your mind is deluded, how would you know? You couldn't. You'd be stuck in this veil of delusion. That's why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, to bring mindfulness to our own contributions to our confusion, delusion, and ongoing suffering. That path leading to awakening is called an Eightfold Path. So the first noble truth is that the Buddha teaches is that dukkha occurs. And it's simply a statement that as a consequence of having a human life, there's going to be disappointing experiences. There's going to be unsatisfactory experiences. And it's really because of the ever-changing nature of all things. Because those things that give us pleasure will change and they will fall away. And there will be disappointment if we've created an identity or an expectation of maintaining these things that give us pleasure. And along the way we'll experience or we'll have experiences that we find unsettling, troubling. And we create an identity, an attachment to those things never occurring again. And of course, now we're trying to control everything from the point of view of an ego personality. Is that clear? And it's through these views rooted in ignorance that we continue to create something called a conditioned mind. And once that conditioned mind is established, we need something to recognize that conditioning and start unraveling it. And that's where the Buddha, again, this comes back to the Eightfold Path. So the Eightfold Path is a path that is rooted in concentration. The Buddha taught meditation for really one reason, to deepen our concentration so that we could support the refined mindfulness necessary to hold in mind the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path. And it is by that refined mindfulness and the integration of the Eightfold Path that we're able to recognize and abandon our own confused and deluded views. Does that make sense? Chris, what do you think of what I just said?
That's a lot to take in.
Yeah. So now, and I'm glad you said that. Diane and Kevin will attest to this, I hope. You'll hear an awful lot of things. And the reason why I gave that probably seemingly too long introduction that is out of context because you haven't heard it before is to lay the context for what we're talking about. Now, everything the Buddha taught for the 45 years of his teaching career was taught in the context of dependent origination in that very first teaching, in the Four Noble Truths. And the reason why that's important is that understanding that teaches us how to apply all his other teachings, because we now have the context, we know where to put things, and it helps us avoid anything that might be confusing and add to our ignorance by attaching it to the Dhamma when it doesn't belong there, when it's not part of what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught a very pure, simple, and direct Dhamma. It only seems complicated when we try to fit it into our views rather than recognize that it's our views that are causing the difficulty and let go of the views. Just to make one more point on that, those three marks, those three conditions that I talked about earlier, anicca, impermanence, anatta, the not self-characteristic, and the resulting dukkha, are what we're hoping to gain insight. There's also a large insight movement in modern Buddhism, and that's really a different type of insight. And again, it's not wrong or even less effective. It's just much more broad than what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught that we're to develop insight into these three specific things that are interrelated. That second characteristic, anatta, is one of the most misunderstood terms in all of Buddhism, even during the Buddhist time. Anatta means not self. It doesn't mean non-self, and it doesn't mean there's no such thing as a self. Both of those contradict what the Buddha taught. The Buddha used that term anatta, which was a common term of his time, but to say something completely contradictory to what those common beliefs were. karma, the word karma is like that rebirth that we'll talk about tonight if I ever get to it, are like that. He used common words, but in a completely different way. So he used the word anatta, not to imply that there's no such thing as a self, not to dismiss the importance of understanding the self, which is often what happens when we say no self, there's nothing here, but to simply say that the views that you're using to support a self are wrong views. Let go of the views. Those views do not constitute a self. That's the Buddha's meaning of anatta, of not self. And that leads directly to the first factor of the Eightfold Path, which is right view, which implies that this Dhamma is a Dhamma of going from a wrong view rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths to a profound right view that has fully developed this path. That's as much of an introduction as I'm going to give, because I think that's enough.
Are we going to meditate?
No. No, not tonight.
Come on.
No, we've talked too much tonight. There's no time to meditate. Yes, we are. Diane reminded me a couple of weeks ago. She knows it. What did you say? I didn't hear what you said.
Takes a while.
Yes, and Diane, a few weeks ago I got off. We usually meditate before I start talking too much, and Diane caught me a few weeks ago when I was halfway into the class. Are we going to meditate? So I'm almost done. I just want to ask both of you, do you have any questions about all of that? And please don't be overwhelmed by it.
What did you hear? Well, I read a little bit about it before. And I know it's a broader picture of like the certain words that we use and we think of, well, it means this, and it's sort of like you have to relearn how to think about things, or like unlearn what you've learned.
Yes.
Or just like not expect that you're going to find answers where you think they're going to be. So I think that maybe that's what I'm hearing.
That's right. That's the essence of wrong views, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so all of this, the developing the Dhamma really takes is a willingness to accept that we have wrong views and to recognize them. And when we recognize them, to simply abandon them. We don't analyze it. We don't have to. We don't get into any of that. We recognize that they're just views rooted in ignorance. There's no other value except the recognition. Let them go. And the way to do that is through a continued meditation practice within the framework of the Eightfold Path, which is what I teach and what you'll hear me saying over and over again. So that introduction that I just gave, that you are hopefully going to forget as soon as you leave here, will form the foundation for what you'll learn, hopefully, when you continue to come back here. And that's the only reason I give that long-winded explanation, just to lay the context for what hopefully you'll understand here. Now, a typical class is we begin with meditation, and then I give a talk based on one of the suttas. There's nothing you'll hear here that is outside of what I know and what has been proven to be the teachings of the Buddha. In that way, we get to hear things over and over again, and slowly over time, we begin to integrate it. Just briefly, would both of you explain how that's worked for you? Just hearing, and the things that I teach are hopefully unique, but they're also repetitive because the Buddha only taught in that context. So even different suttas, when you know how they apply, are resurrecting that theme. Kevin, what would you say about the necessity for repetition?
I think it's excellent. I've been meditating for a year and a half or so, and I came to it like you did. I didn't know anything about it when I started, and I started on my own a little bit, and then through circumstances, I found John too, and it was exactly what I was reading about and wanting forever. And at first, it seemed overwhelming that, you know, this is a lot to learn, I have to memorize a lot. But then, really, it's very simple. And repetition is great. John's explanations of it are great. And books are great too. I see it with different eyes now, you know, in your life.
And you feel the you experience the effects of it. You have it's a practical practice. In other words, it's not just something out there.
Yeah,
on a daily basis.
Profound change in my life.
Yes, and that's what the Buddha was set out. He wasn't concerned about teaching you something that if you did certain things throughout your lifetime. In a future life, and this relates directly to what we'll talk about tonight, in a future life, you'll get your reward. He taught that human beings have the capacity. In fact, I would say the charge to awaken in this lifetime. And that isn't meaning gaining full human maturity. He taught that this is a Dhamma for this lifetime, not a future lifetime. In fact, he really taught to awaken so you're not leaving the possibility for a future birth rooted in ignorance. Diane, what would you say about the importance of hearing things over and over again?
I grew up with my father saying, "I'm only going to tell you this once." And immediately when he said that, I went blank, because the stress of, oh my God, I gotta remember this was, you know, too much for me. And therefore the repetition of things, as deluded a mind as I had anyway, when I came here, and I've been coming to the classes for about 6 years, 5 or 6 years now, and I feel fortunate in that no way would I have gotten what you got tonight when I first came. He wasn't quite into this part of it. So when people come in that are brand new and know, and it sounds like you need a little bit more, and going to the UU church, I go there occasionally myself. So anyway, you have a little more knowledge than I did. So when people new come in, I get concerned about the anatta and all that stuff.
That's all. How was the repetition? How did the repetition help you get past all that?
I needed it.
Yep.
I needed it.
That's why we do it.
I needed it to keep going and I needed it to undo, to chip little away at the deluded thinking that I had.
Yeah, and that's really the main reason for it, because a mind that's rooted in delusion will create these very powerful but subtle strategies to continue to ignore its own ignorance, and that's where it comes up. And well, I heard this before, and this is why I don't think it's going to apply to me, or I heard that before, and it's like a game of whack-a-mole. This aversion or this resistance to understanding the truth of who we are comes up in all kinds of ways, and so that's where the repetition comes in. And you'll understand that. The meditation method I teach is called Shamatha Vipassana meditation. Shamatha means to quiet the mind. Vipassana means to gain insight, and it's that very specific insight into those three marks of existence. The Buddha taught this meditation method throughout the 45 years of his teaching career, and despite what has grown up around, he never taught anything else. He taught meditation for one primary reason, and that's to deepen concentration. Now, a mind that is rooted in ignorance is constantly distracted and requires that distraction to continue its ignorance. And that's the reason why using meditation to deepen concentration is so important. As our minds become more well concentrated, and by the way, that keeps meditation simple and direct too, with just that one goal. Through that well concentrated mind, then we can start integrating these other factors. But we can't do it unless we develop a measure of concentration. It doesn't take long. So the meditation method, Shamatha Vipassana meditation, is to be mindful of the sensation of breathing in our bodies. And we're using that mindfulness of the breath to focus us, to deepen our concentration. And you'll find, unless you're spectacularly well concentrated, as soon as you start to meditate, your mind's going to start fall back into the story that's always running. The simplest, most direct, and most powerful thing that you can do at that point is to recognize it and come back to the sensation of breathing. And every time you do that, you're deepening your concentration. The reason why I say that is we can become frustrated by having to do that over and over again. Oh, wow, I'm back in my thoughts again. What's the matter with me? I can't do this. This is too hard. Come back to the sensation of breathing. Even those thoughts that it's too hard or it's too boring or I just don't want to do this are part of the story to recognize the resistance to awakening and come back to the sensation of breathing. So when you remember that, and treat your meditation that way, every meditation session is successful. And you don't start to have to judge it. Oh, that wasn't good. This one was better. You just meditate because it's part of an overall practice that you do. Okay, so let's meditate. And I'll talk us into it. So we close our eyes and close our mouths. And please, Tony, feel free to sit on the floor. And by the way, there's nothing particularly significant about how we sit, except that we sit in a way that we're as comfortable as we possibly can be. I find it to be on the floor. Are you comfortable, Chris? Yeah, you look like you're fine. And Tony, I don't think you need any instruction.
Do you guys bow in here?
You'll find me doing that often, but I don't make a. You won't find a requirement here. But when I only do it, I think for you, because I'm showing the respect for who you are and for what we're doing here. So please feel free to bow. You'll see me doing it often, but don't ever feel like you have to. It's not required. So find your relaxed meditation posture. Let me just, I know I've talked a lot already. The instructions that I give, just to qualify this, are they came out of two important suttas where the Buddha was teaching meditation. Again, these two suttas have been misunderstood too. The Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and the Anapanasati Sutta, which translates to breath awareness. And in both of those suttas, the Buddha directs us to notice the impermanence, first, of in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, of the impermanence of feelings arising and passing away, and thoughts arising and passing away. And by noticing that from a well-concentrated mind, and by noticing the arising and passing away of the breath in our body, it's a direct teaching on the impermanence of all things. And as we come to integrate the impermanence of our own feelings and thoughts, we stop taking them so seriously. We stop taking life personally and start seeing it more realistically, because there's nothing in life that's personal except that we make.
Describe,
I edited out our 20-minute meditation.
Yeah. It all relates to those two important suttas, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness and the Anapanasati Sutta. That last instruction, to notice the quality of your mind, relates directly to the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And as you understand how the Buddha presented that, it's the profound experience of being at peace with our minds when the situation is less than peaceful really is the culmination of an awakened mind. And so that last instruction to notice the quality of your mind and be at peace with it is that instruction towards that fourth foundation, to be at peace with your. And if you think about the qualifications for a peaceful mind, it's to be at peace with our own minds, isn't it? You know? When you understand the Buddha's teaching, the brilliance of the logic, and I'm not promoting logic as a course of study, but as it relates to the Four Noble Truths, the logical nature of how the Buddha teaches is really remarkable, and I hope you see that as we go along. So again, just to put it into context, we're in the 11th week of our 12-week study. We've been, the last 5 weeks, we've been spending a lot of time on the three marks of existence, and the last two classes were on karma, an important subject. And now we're getting on what karma leads to, which is really rebirth. They're two sides of the same coin. These talks are all on the website too, by the way, if you want to listen to them. I think there's now 37 talks on just this series. So when you got a couple of years to kill, it's, you know, something to do. There's a lot of information on the website. So let me start here. These are my words, and I always try to make clear what I'm reading are either my words or the Buddha's words. Many religions, including some Buddhist religions, teach morals and ethics as a way of hopefully having ever more pleasurable future lives. And isn't that true, that we think that if we do enough, even if we're not exposed to Buddhism or religions that much, the inference is that the more moral we live our lives, the better, you know, we might get a reward in heaven or in Buddhism. It's you'll set up a series of ever more pleasurable lives leading to the culmination of awakening. The way the Buddha, if you understand the Buddha's teaching, any future life is a continuation of ignorance and dukkha. We're not striving to have a better life. We're striving to end ignorance completely. And it's ignorance that drives future lives. The most important aspect to understand about rebirth is not what we might give birth to in a future physical life. The Buddha didn't discount that possibility, but he taught that that's not what we want. Because a future life is only another life rooted in ignorance. What we want to do is recognize and abandon ignorance in our own minds. So what's most important is what is occurring in this moment and what's occurring within our minds in this moment. Because as we deepen our concentration and develop that refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, then we are giving birth to the next moment rooted in that understanding. Without that, we can only give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance, and what will follow from that is confusion and more unsatisfactory experiences. So it really brings our thinking back to what's occurring right now in my mind in relation to the outside world, but understanding that what's occurring in the outside world is nothing personal, to maintain that calm and peaceful mind. And that's really the important thing to remember about rebirth. What am I giving birth to in the next moment? And that, if we are developing the Dhamma, hopefully what we're giving birth to in the next moment is something that's moving us towards awakening rather than continuing our own ignorance. This continued clinging to an idea of an ego self, trying to create a future more pleasurable birth, is clinging to the idea of a individual soul that transmigrates from one life to the next. And again, that contradicts everything the Buddha taught. He taught that what constitutes a self, and this relates back to anatta, what constitutes a self is always in a continual process of becoming. And so the question is, becoming what? If what I'm mindful of in this moment is rooted in ignorance, I can only become further ignorant. If what I'm holding in mind in the moment is rooted and framed by the Eightfold Path, then I can become awakening. And that's the important understanding of what we're going to become and what this moment holds, the potential of each moment. The Buddha said upon his awakening, describing his awakening, "This was the third knowledge I attained in the third watch of the night." The third watch of the night is typically the late morning just before dawn. Ignorance was destroyed. Notice the first thing the Buddha teaches and teaches us to recognize is the most important thing. Ignorance was destroyed. The Buddha is he's not talking about anything mystical, magical, otherrealmly, otherworldly. Ignorance was destroyed. Knowledge arose. Knowledge arose about what? Knowledge arose about these four truths. Knowledge arose, darkness was destroyed. Yes, and he's declaring enlightenment. Darkness was destroyed. Light arose, as happens in one who is heedful, ardent, and resolute. He didn't notice again one of the things that I've learned about reading the suttas is that the Buddha never wasted a word. It said that he gave 84,000 discourses. It's a lot of talking, and his consistency of what he was talking about is remarkable when you read it. I'm going to read that again. Light arose, as happens in one who is heedful, ardent, and resolute. He's not talking about just himself, is he? He's talking about anyone who is heedful, ardent, and resolute. Those are words that he uses in those two suttas I just mentioned, and he mentions that all. Heedful means mindful. Ardent means focused on the Eightfold Path. And resolute means that we have resolved to develop the Dhamma. And one who is ardent, heedful, and resolute. Then he says, birth is ended, the integrated life fulfilled. Now that when I do my translations from the suttas, and you hear the word integrated, the suttas the word is usually the holy life. But to me, the holy life points to a holistic life. Remember, even the words are translated from Pali, usually to German, sometimes to Italian, and then to English. So there's some changes in there. But what we're talking about is integrating the Eightfold Path as this holistic life. The integrated life is fulfilled. The task is done. Notice that last line, the task is done. There's many teachings that there's really nothing to do except to experience our own nature. Well, that might be possible, except the Buddha never taught that. He taught that there is an important task to do, and that's to develop the Eightfold Path. That's the task. Here he's declaring, in this one who has been ardent, resolute, and heedful, they have accomplished the task. The task is now done. Then he concludes that, for me, there is nothing further for this world. So what does that mean? When the Buddha awakened, I keep looking at that because I want to get a chat. There's often pictures of the Buddha with his hand right over his solar plexus, pointed up, and his right finger touching the ground, and with those words. The integrated life has been lived. The task is done. For me, there is nothing more in this world. And he touches the ground to signify, you can't see what I'm doing, he's touching the ground, to signify that he has overcome the world's bait. He has left the world behind. And that's what he's declaring. And then he says, for me, there will be no future births. It points directly to the purpose of the Dhamma, to cease creating the conditions. Now, the Buddha isn't only talking about a future physical birth. He's talking about, remember in the context, he's talking about in this moment, it is not possible for him as an awakened human being to give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. And that's the importance of the Dhamma, to awaken in this moment, in this lifetime. And we can do it by remaining heedful, ardent, and resolute within the framework of the Dhamma. Any questions? Let me just go over this a little bit, and then I'm going to skip forward. And this is out of my book too, so I'm referring to something that Kevin and Diane probably read. Reincarnation is the belief that an individual and permanent soul travels throughout time as the same spiritual entity appearing in a different physical body life after life. That's a typical, that's what you understand as reincarnation, right? Basically. This cannot be reconciled with the teachings on not self, emptiness, dependent origination, five clinging aggregates, and karma. It doesn't reconcile to what the Buddha taught. The self that would reincarnate has been shown to be an impermanent aggregate of physical and mental factors sustained only through the present instant by craving and clinging, meaning we insist on maintaining this view we have of ourself as who we are, despite all the evidence that it can't be true, despite all the struggles that it brings us. And it takes a little bit of concentration and understanding to see that, but that's the point, that the views we're holding of ourselves are wrong views. We have to recognize and abandon those views. Insisting on reincarnating this same entity is insisting on the continuation of karma. It's insisting that who I am is all I'll ever be and all that I ever want to be. And we keep creating the conditions in our own mind to maintain this view of self rather than recognize and abandon those wrong views. I'm just thinking about keeping it. Am I describing this? And you guys already heard this a million times, so you know it. To Tony and Chris, are you understanding this at least on a surface level, what I'm saying? It's making sense to you? Okay. And again, not to overemphasize the point, but it's not future births that we're talking about that are important. It's what we're giving birth to in this moment, and that's why we developed the Eightfold Path. Throughout the Pali Suttas, throughout the Sutta Pitaka, through the Pali Canon, there are stories of people that came in and out of the Buddha's life and would insist that he give them answers to the great questions. There's a Vachagoda, is one of the Vachagoda, the Wanderer. Throughout the Sutta Pitaka, you'll hear Vachagoda coming in and out of the Buddha's life. And he always has these same questions. Where do I come from? Where am I going when I die? Is the infinite? Is the universe infinite or finite? What happens to the Buddha upon death? And the Buddha would, it's often he'd just sit there quietly and showing Vachagoda that those questions are inappropriate. But then he would often say, Vacha, it's your questions that are confusing you. Let go of the questions, implying that those questions are irrelevant to the Dhamma. Now, these are the things that men and women have been seeking out since we've been born, since the beginning of humanity, the great questions. Well, those great questions are distracting because they're seeking to establish a self in an imaginary realm. And if you think about the motivation that comes from, it comes from that intense need that the ego self has for continual self-reference and self-application in some realm. The Buddha said, let go of those questions and focus on what's occurring in your mind right here and right now. Those are the answers. And those other answers are completely irrelevant to the Dhamma. It's not to say that they're not, you can't achieve some level of understanding of those, but who cares? What's most important is the quality of our mind in this present moment. I'm going to skip ahead quite a bit here. The Buddha described dukkha and consistently throughout his teaching career as birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, old age is suffering, not getting what is desired is suffering, receiving what is undesired is suffering. He's kind of describing life and inescapable parts of life, isn't he? He would always conclude that by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. And I'm not going to, that probably going to even make this more confusing, but just the five clinging aggregates are a description of the personal ongoing experience of suffering. And that's all you need to know. So this, we are stuck in this, these wrong views that continue to produce disappointing experiences, continue to produce dukkha. The Buddha did not teach a way of manipulating a more pleasurable future birth. He taught a way of leaving the recurring cycle of dukkha behind. So if the Buddha taught a way of ensuring simply a more future birth, all that we're carrying into that future birth is that ignorance. He recognized that ignorance is the problem, not where we might be in a future lifetime. Ignorance is affecting us in this moment. And he addressed that problem of ignorance through the Eightfold Path. So let me go just a little further. My words, karma is the present unfolding of past intentional acts moderated by present mindfulness. That means that whatever the energetic that's carrying us into this moment can be, the effects of it can be altered by what we're holding or moderated by what we're holding in mind. And if what we're holding in mind is the framework of the Eightfold Path, now we're inclining our karma towards awakening and away from continued ignorance. Is that clear? In order to cultivate the path, to end craving and clinging, and to bring dukkha to cessation, giving birth to another moment of clinging to objects, views, and ideas is simply unskillful. Clinging to wrong views is unskillful. But the difficulty in doing this is accepting that the way I'm looking at the world in relation to myself is a wrong view. It's not rooted in reality. And that's such a difficult thing for an ego self to accept, to simply admit that its views are wrong, despite all the evidence to the contrary. We would probably wouldn't be here if our lives were running perfectly, would we? We recognize that there's something missing. Some of us, it's just that my life is wonderful, but there's got to be more to it than this. And sometimes it's just, I'm so sick of suffering, I got to figure something out. But something drives us to look at something in a different way. So the next moment holds a potential to be free of confusion and suffering, and the next moment holds a potential for freedom, for continued rebirth of anatta. That's the importance of the refined mindfulness that we develop from a well-concentrated mind, to be present with our own lives. And this is where the true peace and freedom of the Dhamma resides, is in right now, as our life occurs. Now, I don't want to imply that we should be focused on the present moment. That's something else that has almost developed its own type of religion. We need to be in the present. We need to be in the now. The human mind can't figure out what now is. We don't think that way. But what we can do is to, through a well-concentrated mind, is to bring ourselves into the continual unfolding of our own life. We can be present for that in a mindful way without any eye-making in that. And so our lives unfold in a peaceful way. And it's possible, isn't it?
I know so.
Yeah. And again, this is all experiential. As we start developing the Dhamma, pretty quickly we have little snippets of experience that, wow, this really works. We're simply more present. We're more at peace. We notice that our relationships with people, and most importantly with ourselves, improve dramatically. And it doesn't take much. It just takes a little bit of effort, that sixth factor of the Eightfold Path. A little teaching on anatta. I wouldn't have normally talked about this tonight, but I think it helps our new folks just to understand this a little bit more. Tony, you may understand. You may have this anyway. But anatta, that second part of the conditions, anatta must establish itself in every object, thought, view, or idea that occurs. Now you think about that. The ongoing stress that we create in our own lives is because whatever is occurring, we have to relate it, fit it to this wrong view, and make that view be approving of what's occurring. And that overcomes our entire ability to be present, because we're always in this judgmental way of looking at the world, a personal way, personalization of what's occurring, rather than simply be having a presence of a Buddha and be at peace with what's unfolding. Anatta must establish itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs. The ego self, anatta, cannot accept any future thought or idea that does not include itself. That's what Baccha Goda, that's what all these great questions. What happens to me in the future? Well, what do you care about what's happening in the future? You don't know what's occurring to you right now. And that's what the Buddha recognized. Bring your mind into the current, into the present moment, into your life as it unfolds. Be present for your own life. And the power and freedom and the liberation of actually doing that is the point of the whole Dhamma. The Buddha states, and this relates directly to karma and rebirth. Karma should be known. The cause by karma, by which karma comes into play, should be known, which is craving and clinging. The diversity in karma should be known, meaning how the effects of our craving and clinging manifest. It can manifest in any number of ways, in infinite ways. And the reason why that's important is we can't track them. We simply have to recognize that dukkha is occurring in our life as a result of a misunderstanding of who we are in relation to the world. And that's enough to incline our minds towards awakening. The result of karma should be known. The cessation of karma should be known. That's the most important thing. And how do we create the cessation of karma? It's through the Eightfold Path. The Buddha concludes by saying, intention, I tell you, is karma. Intending, one does karma by way of body, speech, and intellect. And what is the result of karma? The result of karma is of three sorts. That which arises right here and now, that which arises later in this lifetime, and that which arises following that. So here the Buddha is not discounting a future life, but he's giving us a warning. If you don't deal with what's occurring right now, you're simply setting yourself up for endless suffering. Take control of your lives. Take control of your minds right now. And this is how you do it, through the Eightfold Path. So there's a little more in this that I covered Tuesday night if you want to listen to it. But I want to stop there just to put this a little bit more into context for Tony and Chris. I've talked a lot about things that are probably confusing, especially to you, Chris, because it's the first time you're hearing it. What's most important to remember about this is that a human being developed this Dhamma. He taught it for 45 years. The way it's been preserved for 2,600 years, and again, I won't get into that, but there's information on the website about how it has been preserved and that we can trust the preservation in that. But most importantly, he taught the simple Dhamma was to be experienced directly, and it's through that direct experience that we can judge the efficacy of it. Does it really work for me? And so he, throughout his teaching career, he used this word ehepasika, which means come and see for yourself. But what it really means is if you want to understand this, you must come and see for yourself. You must develop the Dhamma. But very quickly, you'll understand. It doesn't take too long to realize, I think this really works for me. And that just reinforces your own enthusiasm for it. The Eightfold Path is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Using that word right, and remember this is translated from Pali, I could just as easily as use the word appropriate or skillful, meaning appropriate view, appropriate intention, or skillful view, skillful intention. But right view kind of gets right to the heart of the matter. It implies that there's such a thing as wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, etc. And there's a clear distinction between how we live and think within the framework of the Eightfold Path and how we live outside of the Eightfold Path. And so the Eightfold Path, once we integrate it into our lives, becomes a natural expression of who we are. And so the freedom that comes from that is we no longer have to be second-guessing ourselves in relation to the Dhamma or relation to just the world at large. We understand that we're living our lives well integrated. We're living that holy life, that holistic life. Okay, that's it. I think that's enough on rebirth and the rest of everything tonight. Thank you for listening to the Dhamma. Now, usually what we'll do, and we'll do this at every class, is now we'll go around the room and I want to hear what you have to say about your practice, if you have any questions or comments about the Dhamma. And now is the time to question me, if you don't believe what I have to say. So it's okay to question the teacher, by the way. Except you, Diane. No, I'm just kidding. Tony, good to see you. Welcome to our Sangha. I'm so glad you joined us tonight.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's very, very good to have this kind of thing in the world. It's, as has been said, having a variety of things being thrown at us, like be it different styles of teaching, different expressions of the truth, different ideas of truth, different hobbies, whatever,
mm-hmm.
can throw the mind. Directions.
Yeah.
So it's good to have focus for sure. Yeah, I'm really grateful that you're doing this for us.
Yeah. We're grateful you're here.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you joined us. I'm going to talk to Chris and then I'll just a little bit of something, a little bit more about what we're doing here. Chris, I'm so glad you joined us tonight. How was your meditation first? I asked you before. It was something that you were able to maintain the method, correct?
Yeah, I thought that it was going to be more difficult, but I feel like maybe at this point in my life, I get something that was like welcoming. Like it felt warm. It felt light.
Mm.
It felt like right.
Mm.
It was a lot more peaceful than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, good for you. Did 20 minutes seem hard to do to maintain it for 20 minutes?
I just thought it was going to be different.
Yeah, good. The reason why I ask is that 20 minutes is a long time for most people for a first sit. Not necessarily so, and you're a good example of that. The reason why I ask is if you're going to start a practice at home, and I hope you do, it's best to start with shorter, smaller periods of meditation, 2, 3, 4, or 5 minutes, until you're comfortable with that. And if you can do that twice a day, very quickly you're going to have a well-established meditation practice. If you're comfortable going longer than that, that's fine too. But don't feel that you have to meditate 20 minutes right off the bat. You don't have
to.
Sure.
I don't know that I'm going to be able to do it alone. It was like a lot easier with other people.
It is. That's why I'm saying it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, one of the reasons why we have this is most people feel that they need a sangha in order to deepen their meditation practice. In fact, I've met very few that were able to develop a solitary practice that was successful. So short periods of meditation, twice a day, and if you can do that around 12 hours apart, it just provides a nice balance to a 24-hour day. There's a recording. There's recordings of this meditation, just the way I described it tonight. On the website under guided meditations from 5 to 45 minutes, so you can use that to guide your practice. And you've been on the website too, so there's and again, I try to organize the website as best I can, but even that can get overwhelming. But if you look at the drop down menu at the top, it has all the different subjects. You started with for new visitors, that's a good place to start, and then maybe just work your way through the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. There's talks associated with almost every article. I've written a couple of books that are out there. I'm not trying to sell books, and in fact, if you want me to give them to you, I will. But that gets into a little bit more detail, obviously, of what we do here. And we have retreats a couple times a year besides our classes here. So our next retreat is in 5 or 6 weeks. It's coming up. Those are a time to spend 4 days really immersed in the Dhamma. And the other thing I would say is that if you can keep joining us, it's the Sangha. Ananda, who was the Buddha's cousin and was his chief attendant for the last 25 years of his life, heard every sutta the Buddha ever gave, asked the Buddha one day, so, and he was kind of full of himself. He said, so, cuz, what's the most important thing in the Dhamma? And Ananda's waiting for this grand answer. The Buddha looked at his cousin and said, Ananda, the most important part of the Sangha, of the Dhamma is the Sangha. We can't do it alone. And I really found that to be true. And we are so fortunate that what's developed here in Frenchtown, it's really marvelous. There's three classes a week. And our Tuesday and Saturday classes seem to be more well attended than our Thursday classes, although it changes. And the only reason I say that is if you're comfortable with a small class, Thursday night's usually the time to come. But the Tuesday and Saturday sanghas, the benefit of that is you'll hear a lot of different people talking about how they integrate the Dhamma in their life, and that's really helpful too. So again, welcome both of you, and hope you continue to join us. And always feel free to contact me through the website if you have any questions or anything. So, Kevin, good to see you this evening.
Good to see you, Tom. Thank you. That was a great review, and it was great to talk about reincarnation and karma. And, you know, I am beginning to see for myself, and I have seen for myself through meditation. And, I'm agnostic about reincarnation. It just, I think most of us human beings are, I don't know if we can know if there is. The Buddha alludes to it. It was out of his tradition. People still talk about it. And I've actually never really wanted it. I thought, you know, that I'd rather be gone or rather be done at the end of this.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that in taking to the Dhamma that, and I can see how it is and can be a pathway to the end of rebirth. Mm. But I think about, you know, there's in the suttas there's talk about a once returner, you know, a tree mentor, a once returner, and,
mm-hmm.
and then the rest who will keep continuing to return. And the only way I sometimes begin to think, well, maybe I do hope there's rebirth, because if I don't at the time in this life to awaken, then at least I'll have another chance. And maybe I can come back and awaken that time. And there's no way to know.
Well, the Buddha guarantees that.
Yeah.
But that's the right way to look at it. There's a task at hand, and we should accomplish the task, and we can do it in this lifetime. And again, for the new folks, and I think mostly Chris, this might sound a little bit like we're talking about annihilation. To the ego self, it sounds like, you know, the possibility of future lives is in almost like Kevin is describing it, but at least I get to keep myself going for a while. But recognize that it's views of a self that are the problem. It's not physical life, it's not afterlife, it's thinking that's the problem. And it's thinking that has changed. In the Bhadakarata Sutta, the Buddha teaches that we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. And isn't that marvelous that we'll be able to do that? And so then in this moment, we are giving birth to another moment that is rooted in wisdom and not ignorance. Now, this idea of physical birth being significantly different than the birth that we're giving to in the next moment is really a problem of the thinking and a problem of wrong views. We know now that scientists have proven that every moment there's millions of cells that come into existence in our bodies and go out of existence. You know, and that's a process that keeps us alive. If it wasn't that constant process, we would quickly just rot from within. So that's necessary for human life. But what it implies is that each and every moment, this body that I think is permanent is not. From a second ago to now, this is a new body because of impermanence. It's always in a process of becoming. It happens so slow and it's so familiar, we don't recognize the difference. But from one moment to the next, there's a migration of my thinking in a physical body that's always changing. And by the way, that thinking is always changing. That is the same thing that occurs from a physical death to the next physical life. It's just the period of time that's different from one moment to the next or from one life to the next. It's still a continuation of consciousness rooted in ignorance, and that's what we're hoping to end. And that's the only reason why the Buddha referred to rebirth, but with the idea that what you're giving birth to in this moment is the most important thing. And Kevin touched on something else. The Buddha referred to rebirth/reincarnation mostly because he had to. In other words, it was such a common belief and a common so-called spiritual belief that it had to be addressed so that he could take that wrong view that there's something valuable in manipulating a future pleasurable birth that only continues ignorance if that's what we're focused on. And that's what people were doing. And they did all types of different things, much like they do today, doing things to appease the spiritual system or a God to ensure a better future rebirth rather than addressing the issue of what's at hand, is my confused thinking. Diane, good to see you tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being here and doing this so steadfastly, sir.
I always say, what else would I do?
Yeah, but it's changed my life.
Mine too.
Steadiness. Thank you. Part of what this rebirth or what you're talking about means to me is that I have choices, and I don't think I ever realized. I mean, I've heard this thing, change your thinking, change your life, all along, you know, for a lot of years now, but I didn't really quite get it, and I keep getting it increment by increment. That I can, and this is the rebirth kind of thing, I can continue self-battering. I can continue projecting that it's going to be a bad day. I can continue a lot of things in my life. Or I can accept the moment as it is, good or, and this is what I think I really love about Buddhism, or the thing that the way of thinking of it is that it's a new way of thinking. I can give birth to a, how do I say this? I have choices. I guess I've said it.
Yeah.
I can keep doing the same thing over and over again, or I can take, and that's what I like about the meditation part of it, and the whole eightfold, the whole shamil, is that I can take a breath, and I do this all day long. I can catch myself now saying, thinking something poopy, and I'll take a breath. I say, okay, you can take a breath now. And one of the things I thought that you taught early on was that every time I take a breath in the middle of one of my stories, I weaken the story.
Yep.
And I love that. It's taken me a long time to weaken some of the stories, and some of them have gone poof a little bit, you know, or dissipated. The narrative stay, but the story, the emotions and the whatever junk is behind the story leaves. That is such a, you know, baggage reliever kind of thing. So I'm grateful.
Yeah, I am too. Thank you for saying that. The two important points you bring up that I didn't mention, that simple thing that we do in meditation, we find that we're caught up in our thinking again, we acknowledge it, and we come back to the sensation of breathing. That interrupts ongoing ignorant thinking. It interrupts that constant story we have in our minds, and it's that story that's maintaining wrong views. So that's the reason why this simple and direct meditation method that the Buddha taught is so effective in as part of the Eightfold Path, because it interrupts conditioned thinking. It interrupts ongoing ignorant thinking. And it's so powerful and effective. That simple, and think about that. The transformation, the transformative power of that simple act and direction that's followed the way it's intended, to come back to the sensation of breathing. And then to integrate that well-concentrated mind in that broader framework of the Eightfold Path, again, the brilliance of this awakened human being. And every one of those factors is necessary, but there's nothing extraneous in all of those factors. In other words, everything we do as we develop the Eightfold Path relates directly to awakening. We're not engaging in anything that could possibly lead to more distraction as long as we maintain that integrity. And the other thing that Diane brought up, and if you come to my classes, you hear me say it, maybe to the point of distraction, is to be very gentle with yourself. To truly be a Dhamma practitioner, as the Buddha taught, begins with being gentle with ourselves, to let go of any harsh judgments we have of ourselves, and certainly in relation to how we're practicing. If we just develop the framework of the Eightfold Path and not put any more conditions on that, we will awaken. Be very, very gentle with ourselves. It's the key to everything. Mm-hmm. You think about how the Buddha is often depicted. To me, that's the essence of being gentle with myself, isn't it? Just being at peace with accepting my life and the life around me as it is. And so an ego mind will say, but what about all the troubles in the world? What about this and what about that? How can you be at peace with that? How can you not be if you have the understanding of the Buddha? Because that's when you're most effective in the world, being at peace. And then you can respond to what's occurring in your life from an appropriate point of view rather than a wrong view. And in that way, you'll no longer contribute to the suffering in your life and the confusion in other people's lives. There's a famous sutta, and I'll end tonight's class with that. It's called the Salata Sutta, the Sutta on the Two Arrows. And in that sutta, the Buddha teaches that the suffering in the world is going to arise as a consequence of having a human life. There's going to be sickness, aging, and death. There's going to be disappointment from not getting what we want or getting what we don't want. But in the end, we recognize that as simply a continuation of having a human life, and it doesn't affect me at all. I can be at peace no matter what occurs. That's the peace of an awakened human being. That's what the Buddha taught. And it's within, that is what is within each and every human being. That's not Buddha nature. It's not Buddhahood. It's simply an awakened human being in this lifetime, and we can all do it. So thank you for a wonderful class there, folks. And again, I know I covered an awful lot of material tonight. Please don't be overwhelmed, but over time, it all makes sense. Any questions before we close? Okay. We close all our classes with something called metta from a sutta. I know Tony. Metta means loving kindness or goodwill. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. I'm having trouble finding it. Becoming mindful of the sensation of your body, breathing in your body, becoming mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the words of the Buddha from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.